How you doing? We were, in the last few weeks, discussing the life and teachings of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and the Shikshastaka prayers of Chaitanya. And this deep yearning that Mahaprabhu felt for the presence of the names. And there was that lovely question, I don't remember who it was who asked it. Might have been Tamar, about going from one mantra to another. And what's the difference between just kind of sampling a number of mantras? If all mantras, authentic mantras, are spiritual, transcendental, and that sound is purifying, why not chant them all and have a kind of a little banquet of mantras, as opposed to the bhaktas who seem to focus on this one mantra, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. And it is the difference between maybe an open house and an intimate affair with your beloved. Inviting many people into your life, which is wonderful. But there's something kind of unique and special and intense, more intense, about focusing on the name of Krishna and just allowing that relationship to grow. How's everybody doing? How are you? Nice to see you all again. What's your name?
Anna.
Annie?
Anna.
Anna. Anna. Hi, how are you?
Good.
Good. Nice to have you with us. So, I don't see too many people who are here for the first time. So, are you here for the first time?
I was last year.
Last year. Right? And please remind me of your name.
I'm Anna.
So, two Annas.
Three
Annas, of course. Yes. All right. Well, the word Anna in Sanskrit, I don't know if you, do you know what the name means in Sanskrit?
Something of the provider of nourishment.
Yeah, it's nourishment. It's it can be variously translated as the bounty of the earth, grains, harvest. And there's a verse in the Bhagavad Gita, Anad Bhavanti Bhutani Parjanya Anasambhava. I think it might be in the fourth chapter. I think it's the next chapter coming up, almost at the end of the third chapter, where Krishna describes that the bounty of the earth, the harvest of the earth, grows by the grace of rainfall. And rains come from the performance of yajna. In the Vedic perspective, there's a symbiosis between humanity and nature. And by our behavior, by a proper behavior, a respectful, loving behavior toward nature, nature reciprocates. Nature is not just an inert concept, but a living, breathing force. And by honoring nature, nature honors us. So this is called yajna, or the offering of something to a higher purpose. So your name is very auspicious, very lovely name. Describes when one is practicing yoga properly, you're what comes. So thank you. You are gracing us on acknowledging the wonderful yoga practice of all the people here by your company. Thank you.
Where's Joshua?
He was, yeah, that's another. Yoga Ishwara, Jata Jogeshwaro Krishna. That's at the end of the Bhagavad Gita. Where Sanjaya, who is the person who is channeling this discussion that's taking place between Krishna and Arjuna, tells the blind king Dhritarashtra, to whom he is recounting this discussion between Krishna and Arjuna, he says, I can't believe what I've just seen. This is phenomenal. What I've just seen and what I've just heard is giving me ecstasy at every moment. And he says it three or four different times. I'm in ecstasy, I'm in ecstasy, I'm in ecstasy by this discussion of the Bhagavad Gita. And then he says, it is my opinion, O King, that where there is Yogeshwara, which is Krishna, I'm Yogeshwara Das, where there is Krishna, the master of yoga, and where there is Arjuna, the ultimate warrior, there is sure to be victory and glory. That's how the Bhagavad Gita ends, is that statement. So a little bit of housekeeping. I think we've kind of made a commitment now. Our next potluck dinner will be February 14th. And
Valentine's Day.
Huh? Valentine's Day. So the theme will be hearts. Very appropriate for the Bhagavad Gita. Yeah, so if you have this urge to kind of take part in the preparation for this, would you kindly just let Kim know? She's our master of ceremonies for our potluck dinners. And then there was a suggestion that the next retreat to the Tigers Preserve in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, take place in April. So I have a question for you. Do you have a preference? The first weekend, April 6th through 8th, coincides with Passover. So I don't know if that would be a problem. Is that a problem? Yeah,
yes.
That doesn't work.
Yes.
Right. So then how would you feel about April 13th through 15th, middle of April, for the Tigers Preserve Retreat? Does that sound like my thing? It's a Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
When is Easter?
When is Easter?
April 9th.
April 9th? So it's after Easter. So is that a possible date? Okay. So we'll send out information about that as it happens. Okay. So we are within inches of the end of the third chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. This is a big event here. We're in the next to last verse. So if you have your copy of the Bhagavad Gita as it is, we are on page 178. 178. So would you kindly repeat the invocation? It's chapter 3, verse 42. So would you kindly repeat the invocation after me, and then we'll repeat the verse. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. This is Bhagavad Gita, chapter 3, text 42. Indriyani paranyahu. Let me try that. Indriyani paranyahu. Indriyebhya paramana. Indriyebhya paramana. Manas. Speak at once now. Anyone? No takers. Not even one. All right, Nick, go for it. Yep, 42. Translation. The working senses are superior to dull matter. Mind is higher than the senses. Intelligence is still higher than the mind. And he, the soul, is even higher than the intelligence. The working senses are superior to dull matter. Mind is higher than the senses. Intelligence is still higher than the mind. And he, the soul, is even higher than the intelligence. This is one of those verses in the Bhagavad Gita that you can kind of chew on for about a month. It's so rich and so such a concise description of the situation that we find ourselves in this world. Walking through the landscape of the Bhagavad Gita, we derive a clearer perception of where we have been. We derive a vision of where we are currently, and we catch glimpses of where we might go. And this particular verse does an extraordinary, extraordinary job of describing where we are currently. What is the, if you will, the layers of matter that we have to work through to achieve a true sense of our eternal spiritual identity. So let's look at this verse and break this down a little bit. The working senses are superior to dull matter. Well, in weeks gone by, we've talked about how the senses engage with their objects, and when they are successful, when the senses, meaning all of the different senses, not just the senses of perception, such as the sense of smell and the sense of sight, but also the sense of intuition, the things that we believe will bring us satisfaction and will distance us from discomfort and pain. When the senses engage with those activities and objects that are conducive to sustaining life, the brain rewards us with dopamines and all kinds of endorphins and other chemicals that are created in the little pharmacy that we have up here in our skulls. For example, eating is pleasurable. Why is it pleasurable? Because it's conducive to sustaining life. Sex is pleasurable. Why? It's conducive to sustaining and perpetuating life. So the body rewards those things that are healthy for it and keep it alive and well functioning. Trauma can complicate that. And so there may be instances when pleasure and pain become interchangeable. But let's say in a non-neurotic environment, generally speaking, we distance ourselves from pain and from risk and danger, and we welcome those things that enhance the satisfactions and pleasures of our life. Okay, but the senses are not particularly discriminating. They'll engage and find and accept activity that are gratifying in the moment. The senses do not have a discriminating faculty to say that I should postpone this now because this may not be beneficial for me in the long term. So that's where the mind comes in. Above the working senses is the mind. So the Gita describes the mind as the data bank of impressions. All of the various things that you've seen, heard, encountered, learned over the course of a lifetime are stored in this data bank of the mind. Your senses are drawn to something, all right? The mind does this Google search. Okay, yep, that's good. We've enjoyed that before. We like that. Let's go get some more. Oh, that's hurt us in the past. Let's stay away from that. So the mind helps the senses to know when to engage and when not to engage. Actually, there's never really been a clear definition of what the mind is. It's still uncertain just what the mind is. What is mental health? We really don't have a clear definition of mental health or mental illness. For example, there are indications that mental illness may be culturally specific. You know, there are stories, for example, in Southeast Asia of a condition that men have called amok. Have you ever heard of running amok?
Yeah.
Well, amok is an actual mental condition, a mental state, where there's this fierce aggression followed by a sense of utter forgetfulness, not even remembering having done it. That's called amok. And there's something I don't remember where it is. I think it's in the Middle East, called zar, is a condition among men of laughing and shouting and rolling on the ground, and then waking up a moment later and not remembering having done any of that. That's called zar. In the late 1800s, there was a condition among women in Europe where their legs would stop working. Now, that these things are culturally reflective of, for example, the position that women were in, where they were locked into certain social conventions, and that might manifest as an inability to walk. So mental health and mental illness may have some cultural moorings. They're not like a particular disease that you can track, and it's the same for everyone, everywhere. And so the mind has this function of accepting and rejecting. Like that, that's good. That one's not good. That's healthy. You know, stay away from that. That's dangerous. Survival instinct is a very good thing. I mean, survival instinct is what tells you, there's a car coming at me, I better get out of the way. That's a healthy thing. But in order for survival instinct to work, there are about 1,000 other mental functions that have to shut down. For example, contemplation, analysis, meditation. Why is this car coming to me? What is the driver thinking? There are a lot of other functions that have to stop so that your body knows, get the hell out of here. So that's mental function is meant to be guided by yet a higher force. And that according to this verse of the Bhagavad Gita is intelligence. I think sometimes relationships get messed up because we make this mistake of confusing the impressions from the past with what's really healthy for us right now. We judge by what we have experienced and we project that into a future condition. And so we hold back, and it's a healthy thing. But it does not allow for the possibilities that the future may hold. I love that discussion that we had with Mel Toomey. How many of you were here for Mel Toomey's talk about the difference between management skills and leadership skills? Mel was talking about how management skills refer to looking at the past, looking at results that we like from the past, and protecting the formula that led to those results by repeating them. That's management skills. You manage what has been so that you can derive the same results. Leadership skills he defined as an ability to launch into an unknown future where no experience from the past can possibly tell you what the outcome is going to be. And the willingness to say, you know what, I don't know, but let's try. And of course, along with that, the ability to create community and a cooperation among team players. So that was a marvelous discussion that we had here with Mel. Look what happened before. So we become defensive, and instead of listening openly, we're hearing the mind doing its job, protecting us from harm that we have known in the past. Now, for the mind to perform that function, it has to be able to roam freely. Random access memory. Right? Going through all of that information, the mind has to be free to do that. So it's very unstructured, this free roaming mind, to do its job. It's doing its job. When we talk about the citta vrittis of the mind, the agitations of the mind, well, that's its job. The mind's job is to be constantly agitating. How do I accept this? Do I come to it or go away from it? What do I do in this situation? What do I do here? How does this fit with my hopes and dreams for the future? How does this work? It's constantly doing that kind of accepting and rejecting. So the mind may have good intentions, but it's not always making wise choices. So the mind also needs to be guided by a superior function. And that, according to this verse of the Bhagavad Gita, is the intelligence. Mind, I know you want this, but I'm telling you, the intelligence may hint, that thing that you think is good or that you want to stay away from, the good thing can turn out to be something really quite bad, and that thing you're trying to move away from is the very thing that you need to be doing. Only the intelligence can make that decision. The mind can't make that decision. The senses can't make that decision. There's a verse in the Bhagavad Gita coming up in another couple of chapters where Krishna says, that pleasure, that happiness, which is like nectar in the beginning and becomes like poison in the end, that is a happiness in the mode of ignorance. And that happiness, which may in the beginning feel like poison, but which eventually becomes like nectar, that is happiness in the mode of goodness. So the ability to discern carefully and maybe distrust those first impressions or the mind's dictates, that comes from a refined intelligence. And that requires education. That requires practice. You have two things in order to perfect intellectual capabilities. You have practice and study. These two tracks are constantly working. What is it that I heard this morning? Yeah, do you know the musician Youssou N'Dour from Senegal? Marvelous, marvelous artist. I think it was Peter Gabriel who discovered him. And back in the 80s, he was a very important singer-songwriter for the cause of freedom in South Africa. I remember loving his song, "Bring back Nelson Mandela, bring him back home to Soweto." Just really fabulous stuff. He's running for president of Senegal. So there's a big controversy, you know, because he became very successful. He has an operation with about 600 employees and so on. He's really become quite successful. But he doesn't have much political experience, so a lot of heart. So the commentary on National Public Radio this morning was, these two things are needed. You need more than just popularity or artistic ability. You need to have practical wisdom. You need to have those two tracks working simultaneously. So intelligence is a combination of these two things, the study and the practice. Study alone, without practice, becomes dry, academic, theoretical, doesn't really have much reality in the life that we have to live on a daily basis. Practice alone, yoga alone without the Bhagavad Gita, can become sentimental. This feeling, this experiential dimension to life, but without the grounding in knowledge and study, you can lose the interest. You can maybe stop your practice when it becomes inconvenient, when it's no longer something that you can work into the rest of your life. The study is what allows you to continue that practice, even though the mind and senses are saying, enough, I can't do this anymore. So these two tracks, in the bhakti tradition, you have trying to remember the Sanskrit, I think it's called Vedi Marg, and then the Archana Marg. I may not be using the right Sanskrit terms here, but there's the deity worship and the study of the scriptures. Those are the two parallel tracks in bhakti. The worship of the deity, such as behind the curtains here in this room, is an important emotional dimension to what you study in the sacred texts. There has to be some opportunity to express that sense of what you've acquired to the divinity. So the deity is there. The divinity appears in the form of the deity to receive our service. And whether it's something as simple as having a picture of Radha and Krishna on a little shelf in your home and bringing a flower in the morning or a cup of water and offering that to the picture of Radha and Krishna or with your teacher, your guru there, that expression of love nurtures the field of devotion. It's tending the field. So these two things are always working in tandem. What is the downside of intelligence? What do you think the downside is of intellect? We've been saying that the senses have a downside, the mind has a downside, the intelligence has to have a downside. What do you think the downside would be of intelligence? Yeah.
That your heart is closed.
That your heart is closed. Your heart is closed. That can happen, certainly. What would close the heart if you were having a heightened intelligence? Becoming too intellectual?
Uh-huh.
Okay, so there's a risk of the intellect overwhelming the heart? Yeah, okay. Nova? Can you speak up a little? Intelligence is looking for the limits of something. Uh-huh. So it's a process, it's a mechanical thing that...
It could be certain,
yeah.
To
okay. All right, so that could be a downside of intelligence. Share?
I'm sensing that maybe the intelligence might take itself too seriously and that it may perceive itself as knowing the truth.
Ah, okay, all right. Very good. Now you've come close to what the Bhagavad Gita describes as the downside of intelligence. In the... I believe it's the 18th chapter. I should know this, but I don't. Krishna describes that the downside of intelligence is becoming conditioned by a sense of superiority. I'm such an intellectual. Right? And that sense of knowing, I know you don't know, right? That is as dangerous a conditioning as ignorance. It's a different kind of conditioning, but it is still a material conditioning. So just being smart is not the same thing as being wise. Very, very different thing. Michael, did you have something else you wanted to add to this? Yeah, okay. So intellect also has its downside. And therefore, this verse of the Bhagavad Gita says, the soul is higher than the intelligence. The Atman, the source of consciousness within the body, is superior even to the intelligence. Now, I remember Prabhupada one time holding up two fingers and saying that the intelligence and the soul are this close. Intelligence is really just a short step away from wisdom. Intelligence imparted by and cultured by a qualified teacher transforms into wisdom. So it's very, very close. And then, therefore, it can also be misused very easily. You know, you ever hear enough of, you know, knowing just enough to get yourself into trouble? Yeah.
Kim lent me a book, and just now, as I was reading the cafe, there's a story in it about a Brahmin who was this close to enlightenment, but he couldn't reach total enlightenment because he was a Brahmin and he had knowledge of the caste system. He knew that he was in the upper echelons of the caste system. And so Shiva comes in to teach him a lesson, and Shiva disguises himself as a drunkard and a meat eater, and is walking along a narrow path where, as a as one of the lower cast members, the dancer, it's spelled like T-R-E-Y-Y, I don't know how it's pronounced. But, anyway, as a member of this lower caste system, he's supposed to jump into the mud so that the Brahmin can walk by, but instead he stumbles around like a drunkard, and this Brahmin like berates him and says, "How dare you stand in my way, I should have you beheaded," and blah, blah, blah. And then he says, "Well, you know something, let me ask you a couple of questions. Do we not both bleed when we are cut? Do we not both eat rice from the same field?" And he's asking all these philosophical questions, and the guys begin to realize, like, oh, this guy, he knows something. This is, this guy must be someone in disguise. And then he meditates for a moment, and he says, "Oh my God, you must be Shiva." I says, "Yeah, I am Shiva, and I did this to teach you a lesson."
Right.
And,
so there.
And so, yeah. And so he says, "So now you see, you're so attached to this caste system, and you know so much about who's above who and all, you know, who's a Brahmin and who's not, and that's the one thing that's keeping you from becoming an enlightened person."
Now, Nick, translate that for us into the life that we live today in the 21st century.
Well, I mean, all right, so the immediate thoughts, that I'm thinking are, you're affluent and, you're rich and you feel, like, entitled. You think that your job as a white-collar guy makes you... more entitled than a blue-collar worker. And because of that, you miss out on learning the culture of working with your hands.
Well, that's an obvious translation of the story. How about something a little bit less obvious, a little bit more nuanced? Beth?
I practice yoga and I don't eat meat.
Yes, that's right. Watch, hear me roar. Yes. How about the sense of control over nature, that by my knowledge, by our knowledge, we can dominate nature? Or anything, really, even in the arts, anything that cultivates ego, that gives us a sense of superiority because my insights into the human condition are so deep. Look at all the books I've written. And anything that feeds that sense of superiority. The simple matter is, how can anyone expect to make any spiritual progress if they think themselves better than anybody else? So intelligence has its downside. Therefore, what's happening in this verse is it's so beautiful. The intuitions of the soul, the soul's true fulfillment, can be so counterintuitive to the demands of the senses, the impulses of the mind, and the certitude of the intelligence, that we might go so far as to say what the soul can do that none of those other things can do is to dream, to aspire to a place beyond something that we might not even be able to imagine. The world we know and the world we don't know. There's a story. Can I tell you a little story? All right. This story is a very, very popular story. It's there in Poland. There's a version in Germany. There's a version in Italy. There's certainly a version in India. And it's the story of a peddler. A poor but kind, generous and thoughtful soul. And this peddler lived in a tiny little hut under a cherry tree. And the only fortune that this peddler had was this cherry tree, that he would marvel at the beauty of this tree. And yet when the birds would come and sit on the branches of the tree and eat all the cherries, he would never chase them away. He would always feel great satisfaction that the birds could be fed and nourished by this one little tree that he had next to his hut. And what he would do, he was an elder man, and he would pack up his little bag and head off in the morning and go to town and spread his old ratty cloth out on the square and put his little objects that he had to sell. And more often than not, he would end up giving them away. A young child might come up and say, "Hey, Mr. Peddler, how much is that little penknife over there?" He'd say, "5 cents." The boy would shake his head and start to walk away. And the peddler would say to him, "Well, I'll tell you what, why don't you take that little knife? Because it'll do you a lot more good in your pocket than it would in the bottom of my bag." Another day, a little young girl would come by and say, "Hey, Mr. Peddler, how much are those pretty ribbons there?" He'd say, "5 cents." And the girl would shake her head because she had no money, and she'd start to walk away. And he'd say, "Ah, I'll tell you what, you know, those ribbons are going to look a lot prettier in your hair than they are at the bottom of my bag. Why don't you just take them?" And he went along like this till there was practically nothing left. And he went home one night, no food, no money. It was cold out. And he crawled up under his ratty little blanket. And the next morning, he could barely get up. He had no strength. So he stayed in bed all day long. The next night, an angel came to him in a dream and said to him, "Old man, get up, walk, and you will hear what you should hear, and you will see what you should see." And the next morning, the old peddler woke up and said, "That was a strange dream." But he didn't have the strength to get up, so he stayed under that ratty little blanket all day long and fell asleep again that night. And a second night, the angel appeared to him in a dream and said, "Old man, get up, walk, and you will hear what you should hear, and you will see what you should see." And again, that second morning, he tried to get up and he couldn't do it. When the angel appeared to him again on the third night, it was more than he could bear. And the next morning, he got up with whatever little strength was still left in him, trudged on down the road, arrived in the center of town, didn't know where to go, didn't know what to do. He just stood there all day long, watching people coming and going. No one paid him any mind. Nobody talked to him. The sun was setting, and he said to himself, "Well, I guess it's time for me to get myself together and wrap this old ratty blanket around me and go down that alley over there and lie down and die." Just at that moment, the innkeeper from across the road walked out and said, "Hey, old man, I just got to ask you a question. What the heck have you been doing all day? I've been watching you here from my inn. You've been standing there like you've been waiting for somebody to come along. You don't talk to anybody. I can see you're hungry, so I'll tell you what. I can satisfy your hunger if you'll satisfy my curiosity. So you come on in here." And the peddler staggered into the inn and sat down at a table. And the innkeeper brought him a meal. And the peddler had a better meal then than he'd had for a long time. And with the little bit of strength that he got back, he turned to the innkeeper and said, "Well, I'll tell you. I dreamed a dream." The innkeeper sat up. His eyes got big as saucers. And he laughed, the biggest laugh he'd ever laughed in his life, slapped his knee and said, "You what?" And the peddler said, "I dreamed a dream." And the innkeeper said, "Old man, how foolish can one person be? Chasing after dreams. Everybody dreams. I dream. But do I go chasing after dreams? You see me sitting here taking care of business, and therefore I can take an old fool like you and sit down and give him a meal." He said, "Well, just last night I had a dream, stupid old dream. I dreamt that an angel came to me. And the angel said that if I would walk a day's journey down the road, I'd come to this little hut underneath a cherry tree. And if I dug under that cherry tree, I'd find a big box of gold. Do you see me running off chasing stupid dreams? No, I stay here and I take care of business." Well, the peddler smiled, nodded thanks to the man, got up, walked on down the road, got back home, took his rusty shovel out of the shed, went over to that cherry tree, dug under that cherry tree, and dug under that cherry tree. And sure enough, there was this box, And he opened that box, and inside was gold and silver and coins and jewels. And the good that that old peddler did with all that treasure, I don't have enough time to tell you. So isn't that a nice story? Now, there are stories like that in a lot of cultures of the world. Now, and what is it saying after all? Well, let's look at this a little bit. Let's study this just a little. First of all, the peddler was predisposed to goodness. Now, the Bhagavad Gita says that sattva guna, goodness, is the stepping stone to transcendence. You can't leap from ignorance to transcendence, except by one exception. Can you guess what the one exception is? If someone is steeped in ignorance or passion and they're not yet at a place of goodness, how can they leapfrog up to transcendence? What's the one way it can happen? You got it. If a pure soul comes and gifts you transcendence, then you don't have to have any other qualification. That comes unbidden. That's like Shakespeare writes, that the quality of mercy is not strained. It falleth like the gentle rain from heaven on the earth below. That's the one exception. Otherwise, generally, for most people, you come to a place of goodness, meaning that you get your act together, you lead a clean, healthy life, you stay away from habits that can bring consciousness down that will hurt others, you practice your yoga, chant your rounds on your beads, and then gradually there's a reawakening of consciousness that takes place. So the peddler was predisposed to that experience with the angel by virtue of his goodness. Now, what about the angel? Can anyone help with an equivalence in the Bhagavad Gita to what that angel would be? You remember the term Paramatma? Okay, Paramatma means the super soul or the voice of wisdom that's within our hearts. It might have been an actual angel. We're not judging the story. But more often than not, the intuition that we need to know how to move forward in our spiritual life is there within us. That intuition is natural. It's a quality of the soul. And it's defined as a presence of God, of the divine within us, Paramatma. We are Atma. Krishna is the Paramatma. And the two are like two birds in a tree. That's described in the Svetasvatara Upanishad. That the soul and the super soul are like two birds sitting in a tree, side by side, friends. So there's that quality there. And then, of course, ultimately, the point of the story is that you don't have to go very far. The treasure that you seek is very close to home. It's right there in front of you, actually. So that's kind of an overview of this verse from the Bhagavad Gita. The working senses are superior to dull matter. Mind is higher than the senses. Intelligence is still higher than the mind. And he, the soul, is even higher than the intelligence. So, any questions or comments or thoughts? Yeah, Ekayana. I'm sorry that you've heard that.
The intelligence is an explanation of the soul.
Yes.
But you seem to describe it a little bit differently. Your description of the soul seems, more poetic, or.
Well, that was Prabhupada's example of the two fingers side by side.
Right.
Intelligence is just this close to the soul. And we're distinguishing between jnana and vijnana, if you will. We're distinguishing between intelligence as book learning, knowledge, smarts, a good head on your shoulders, and vijnana, which means the practical application of knowledge for best purpose. That's wisdom. That's a higher form of intelligence. So there's the practical intelligence, which is how to get along in the world and how to do things well. And then there's the intelligence that leads to a progressive spiritual life. We're making a slight distinction there between these two.
Thinking about what are the names of the personality traits when you forego pleasure, forego immediate pleasure because you know there's a longer term payoff?
Yeah, those are the two words, preya and shreya. Preya is immediate gratification, something that you see, you go for it, you take it, you've got it. Right? Shreya is a product of intelligence, which says, I'm going to forego what my mind and senses are attracted to because there's a higher purpose that I'm working for. That longer-term benefit is worth the sacrifice. I'm willing to sacrifice this now because there's something more. And where do you get that from? I've been meditating on this a lot lately. I think it's a function of getting a little bit older. That the material things tend to become repetitive. You're all very young, so you may not have understood this yet. But the things that we think we want most, after a while, it wears kind of thin. You know, there is some immediate gratification, you know, in achievement, worldly achievement, projects carried through to some successful end. All of that's really quite lovely. There's nothing wrong with any of that. After a while, it's like I'm thinking of George Harrison, who just got so frustrated with having it all. Yeah, every imaginable material success you can think of. And he got so bored of it all. Just so bored of it. He went to see, the Beatles went to see Elvis Presley. Now, he was their hero. Elvis was, you know, God on earth. And no one had more fans, no one had more success than Elvis Presley. They went to see him out in California. And this was George's, just on the very cusp of his spiritual discoveries. And he was thinking, now we're really going to figure something out. Because if anybody knows what the world's all about, it's the king, it's Elvis. They show up, they go into his estate home. And there he is sitting on a circular couch with his wife Priscilla, wearing a diamond tiara in her hair. Is that her name, Priscilla? Is that what she's wearing? And surrounded was a pool table and lots of guitars around. And, you know, they just kind of sat down like acolytes at the feet of the guru and looked up. And no one was saying anything. So Elvis said, well, I guess if no one's going to talk to me, I'm going to bed. He started to get up. And that kind of broke the ice, and they started talking about things. But it was all about music and which guitars and so on. And George was thoroughly disenchanted and said, is this it? Is this what happened? You get to become the king like Elvis, and it's just a lot more of the same thing? More goods? More acquisition? More stuff? So he walked outside, and he just wanted to be away from all that. It does wear thin after a while, you know. And so to learn that early is a blessing. A blessing. Sounds like they're having fun next door.
Maybe that's one of those lessons. I don't know. You kind of have to maybe actually go through it because. I think about how nice it would be to have a bunch of my nice stuff. I can't help but, you know, feel enchanted by the idea of having like an awesome couch or like, an awesome computer, right. You know.
Uh-huh. Well, there's nothing wrong with those things in and of themselves. There's no verse in the Bhagavad Gita that says you have to be materially poor to achieve transcendence. In fact, it's quite the opposite. You know, the indications in the Gita are it doesn't matter what your material situation is like. As long as you've got that core focus on what your true interests are. That requires practice. Yeah, well, that's in the Bhagavatam. That's not in the Gita.
Oh, sorry.
The Bhagavad Puran is kind of the postgraduate study of the Bhagavad Gita. And Akaini is quite right. In the Bhagavad Purana, Krishna says, to those who consider that I favor them, it's because I give them what they want. The ones I'm really favoring are the ones I've taken everything away from. Because he gives himself as a replacement. I'm sorry, you're going to have to speak up. And there's a lot of Christianity in the Bhagavad Gita, and there's a lot of Bhagavad Gita in Christianity.
All the religious traditions, you know, they're all kind of different expressions of the same thing. You know, it's not what you can find in Judaism or Christianity, you can find in the Gita. You just have, you know, maybe you weren't ready to learn it at that time. You know.
What are the differences between the Bible and the Gita is the actual words of God.
Spoken like a true believer.
But there is a source of people who
believe that. Also, if you're saying the Bhagavad Gita, it would start with the story. It's also hearsay. It's not, it wasn't written by God.
In this case, and the God's fault, and then it goes.
Okay. This is one of those lovely little areas of thin ice where we can all fall in the pond. Let's put it this way. The followers of the tradition would say that the Bhagavad Gita is the literal dialogue between Krishna and Arjuna. That it was spoken between these two divine personalities on the battlefield of Kurukshetra. That Vyasadeva, who is an incarnation himself of the divinity, compiled that dialogue in the form of 18 chapters within this larger work called the Mahabharata, which is sometimes called the Fifth Veda. Right, so part of the canon of Vedic texts is the Mahabharata, within which the Bhagavad Gita takes place. That would be the description given by adherents to the tradition. Now, if you want to make a scholar roll on the ground in fits of hysterical laughter, just try to convince him or her that the Bhagavad Gita is the literal word of God. Right? From a scholarly perspective, the Gita is a text that appeared at a certain point in the evolution of what they would call Hindu culture, and that it had a particular role to play historically, socially, culturally, because it was a reaction to the Brahminical authority that was holding the power of salvation aloof from the general public, and there was need for a popular religious tradition. Therefore, bhakti came into being, which is this popular expression that anyone can become enlightened and at one with Krishna. You don't have to be born a Brahmin. So they would describe it as a reaction to the Brahminical authority that held sway at that time in India's history, to which the tradition would say, according to that theory, love of God is nothing but a historic intellectual construct. No, thank you. Now, where I come from is where Michael's talking about. You know, I don't believe that Krishna is something that came along as a response to historic conditions. I, myself, understand Krishna as that force which has for the past, I don't know, I keep losing track, 40-odd years or whatever, informed my vision of the world and my understanding of relationships with other people, and has brought me great joy and happiness and satisfaction. It would be impossible for me to relegate all of that to some kind of dialectical, historical, philosophical construct. Well, here's the wonderful thing about it. I think we're all kind of hinting at it in different ways. Tamar certainly was. Whether one is a believer or not, the Gita is still an extraordinary text. And even if you only accept hypothetically that the speaker Krishna is who he says he is, the divinity in the material world, even if you only accept that hypothetically because that's what he says in the text, what emerges from a reading of the Gita is something so powerful and so inspiring that anyone can find that spiritual progress by the study of this text. So that's, you know, to my way of thinking, the marvel of the Gita is that you don't have to be a believer for the wisdom to have meaning and value. Huh?
Sometimes they read it and then
ban it. They read, yes. Olga's talking about a recent court case in Russia where there was an attempt by the city administration of Tomsk to ban the Bhagavad Gita as an inflammatory text, as a text that incited people to antisocial behavior.
That's in a good way.
Yeah, in a sense, they're quite right.
It's not untrue what they're saying, because it's a different light than the machine.
Very anti-consumer, very...
We're having a potluck.
Right? We're having a potluck.
We're having a potluck?
It's
very social.
Yeah. That's right. How can they say we're anti-social? Come to our potluck and then say... So we have a few minutes and you're welcome to offer any other thought. This is one of those verses that really has always stayed with me as being very important, because whenever I've confronted a situation where I feel that I'm controlled by my circumstances, this kind of brings me back to a different place. No, wait, the senses, above the senses there's the mind. Above the mind there's intelligence, but the intelligence is the same. Go deeper inside, gives you resources that you can work with. We have someone from Switzerland here tonight. Hello. Hi. Welcome, Switzerland. What's your name? Jenny?
Janine.
Welcome. I'm having a hard time.
In March,
yes. Okay. Well, welcome back. Oh. Thank you very much. So any further thoughts? Oh. Because I'm a firm believer in the cultivation of the intelligence, I brought some books that I wanted to tell you about. May I?
Yes.
You might want to, if you're, this is a kind of a just grab these off my shelf as a sample of the kind of books that I have found inspiring for me in, if you will, learning how to practically apply the teachings of the Gita in a wider arena. So here's one by David Abram called The Spell of the Sensuous. The Spell of the Sensuous. David Abram. I'll read a little bit of the quote on the back. For 1,000 generations, human beings viewed themselves as part of the wider community of nature.
And they carried on active relationships not only with other people, but with other animals, plants, and natural objects, including mountains, rivers, the winds, and weather patterns that we have only lately come to think of as inanimate. How then did humans come to sever their ancient reciprocity with the natural world? What will it take for us to recover a sustaining relationship with the breathing earth? Lovely, lovely description that you might say is a meeting of ecology and psychology. Wonderful book that I recommend to you. This one is a little bit deeper for those of you who are intellectuals. Eric Santner's book on the psychotheology of everyday life.
What's the last name?
Santner, S-A-N-T-N-E-R. Reflections on Freud and Rosenzweig. In this book, Eric Santner puts Sigmund Freud in dialogue with his contemporary friend Rosenzweig in the service of reimagining ethical and political life by exploring the theological dimensions of Freud's writings and revealing unexpected psychoanalytic implications in the religious philosophy of Rosenzweig's masterwork, The Star of Redemption. Santner makes an original argument for understanding religions of revelation in therapeutic terms. Again, for me, this is my particular thing, I find the Bhagavad Gita to be an absolutely pristine study in psychology. Huh?
The name of the book again?
The name of the book is On the Psychotheology of Everyday Life. This book is written by the mother of a Krishna devotee. Her name is Sipi Weiss, and the book is called Post-Traumatic Growth. Now, this is a rather recent development in psychology. We think in terms of trauma as something that deteriorates, that impedes growth, that hinders and compromises growth. Sipi Weiss's research and those of her colleague, Ronnie Berger, suggest something quite different, that we humans seem to grow from stress. You know, if you're living in Hawaii all the time and life's just one big groovy groove, there isn't much impetus to grow. We seem to learn best in stressful conditions. It's a strange thing, but there it is. Marvelous, marvelous, groundbreaking work that I would recommend to you. Sipi Weiss, W-E-I-S-S. You can come up after class and look at these if you like. If you would like to get a kind of overview of the various philosophies of how to define human life, this would be a good volume for you. 10 Theories of Human Nature, Leslie Stevenson and David Haberman. Haberman is a marvelous Sanskritist whose books on Vrindavan and the life of Krishna consciousness are truly, truly wonderful. I would recommend one in particular called Journey Through the 12 Forests of Vrindavan. But this one, a splendid little book. Stevenson has a gift for distilling the essentials of a point of view or system of thought. Chapters on Plato, Christianity, Marx, Freud, Sartre are gems of expository clarity and critical good sense. Wonderful book. If you're interested in understanding what it means to be in ecstasy, I recommend this book by June McDaniel, a wonderful Indologist, called The Madness of the Saints, Ecstatic Religion in Bengal. The saints of Bengal, who are bhakti saints, break the traditional image of what the ecstatic life is like. It's something quite different from what you might imagine. The ecstasy that arises from studying Bhagavad Gita and taking it to its ultimate conclusion of reviving this complete, utter, mad love for Krishna is something that has a rhythm and a cadence and an application in everyday life. So imagine living your life in a state of constant ecstasy over anything that you do. And of course, that was Chaitanya. We saw that in the life of Chaitanya. He would see a tree and fall on the ground rolling in ecstasy. He'd see a rock and start falling on the ground and rolling in ecstasy. Everything became an impetus to that ecstatic love because he saw not just a rock or a tree, he saw Krishna there. The same world that discourages a materialistic person is an impetus to ecstasy for the Krishna devotee. Because you see Krishna there. Same circumstances. Two very different reactions. So that's a wonderful book. And, interestingly, how many of you know Dr. Oz? Mehmet Oz. Okay. Before he became Dr. Oz, he was simply Mehmet Oz. And this first book of his, which has not sold anywhere near as many copies as all of his other books since he got Oprah and the television show and everything, is called Healing from the Heart. I recommend this book to you. It's a marvelous, honest gift by Mehmet Oz, talking about growing up. And in this groundbreaking work, Dr. Oz describes his pioneering work combining cutting-edge Western medicine with such Eastern techniques as acupuncture, yoga, and qigong, as well as such controversial therapies as hypnosis, music, massage, reflexology, aromatherapy, and energy healing. Things you don't hear him talk about quite as much today. And he talks about what it was like growing up and how his father in Iran had this attraction for the sacred music of the Sufis and would invite musicians into their home. So even from a young age, Mehmet was hearing these sounds that were meant for healing the soul. It's a beautiful, beautiful little book. I do recommend that one too. So, there it is. Some recommended readings for you. Any further thoughts? Ideas? What do you want to do? Yeah.
So, other than in dreams, mm-hmm. And I would imagine in meditation, how do we hear the soul?
Other than in dreams or meditation, how do we hear the soul?
Or how do we access it, if that's the highest?
Ah, okay. So if Krishna is saying that above all of these other selves, all of these provisional material selves, there is the eternal soul, how do we access that? How do we tap into that reservoir of inspiration? It's a wonderful, wonderful question. You're kind of anticipating the last verse of this chapter. I'll read it. Thus, knowing oneself to be transcendental to the material senses, mind, and intelligence, O mighty armed Arjuna, one should steady the mind by deliberate spiritual engagement, intelligence, what Prabhupada calls Krishna consciousness, and thus by spiritual strength, conquer kama. What's being implied here is taking that theoretical knowledge of yourself as a soul and just beginning to act that way. Because it's natural, by performing in a spiritual way, more and more awareness of your spiritual identity will emerge. For example, a child learns to walk by practice. But it's only possible because the capacity for walking is there within the child. If that capacity were not there, no amount of practice would lead to the ability to walk. Okay. In the same way, full spiritual awareness of ourselves as eternal Atma, our soul, is there. It's already there within us. By practicing the behavior of someone who is enlightened, the enlightenment emerges. And what does that mean? That means that when the senses draw, don't just do what the mind tells us is acceptable. Use higher intelligence to determine, am I going for the immediate benefit, or is there something more to be gained by postponing that gratification? Am I judging this situation by just what I've known in the past, and therefore maybe misjudging it? Or can I perhaps try something out of the box here, because there's some greater benefit that I can achieve here. There's something more that I can do. It's a a matter of practice and discipline. For myself, the way I try to access that is by making sure that every morning I do my daily chanting. That I'm very, very careful about food. I've had to become even more careful because I don't live in a temple environment anymore. And it's very easy when you work from home, you know, like the refrigerator's right there. So I have to be very, very careful about my relationship with food. Asking myself, am I truly fulfilling the responsibilities that I have to friends and family and loved ones? Am I moving forward in that spirit of compassion for them as eternal souls, as I am an eternal soul? You know, recently we've had these holiday gatherings and dinners and everything. There was a part of me that really didn't want to do any of that. Just like, what? Ugh, you know? Just getting together, the same family. Hey, how you been, Uncle Louie? Yeah. You know, who wants that? You know. And then I realized that wait. That's my conditioned self responding there, and I'm doing a terrible disservice. Uncle Louie, for all of his funkiness and bad breath, is just as much an eternal soul as I am. And you know what? Have I really ever talked to him? Have I walked a mile in his moccasins? Do I have any idea what his story is? Do I really know? So I find myself revisiting my own prejudices and saying, let me not be so judgmental. That's a terrible habit, judging things from what we've done before. And that's really what this verse is all about. This verse says, stop judging by what you've known before. Don't go by your senses and mind. And distrust even your intelligence. Act from here, from the heart. And frankly, what happens then is really quite marvelous. People you might otherwise might have just said, whatever, it's family. All of a sudden, no, it's not family. These are eternal souls. This has a much deeper dimension that I've never really cared to explore.
What did Walt Whitman say? I contain multitudes.
Say again? Yes.
You know, might think you can judge somebody based on how they're acting or what they look like, but that's not a distraction. It's just food.
Every one of us, every individual is that divine spark of Krishna. How can we afford to minimize their value, their worth, their divinity? How can we afford to do that? We shouldn't do that. I guess we have to be practical. You know, if Uncle Louie's going to, you know, lock you in a vice of mundane conversation, then that's the rest of your evening shot to hell. You know, you might want to do something about it. So let me make a suggestion. In that spirit, grab a cookie and go sit next to someone you haven't spoken with and introduce yourself. Get to know somebody here in the class. We do this from time to time, and it's a wonderful way to end class, I think. Just spend a few minutes getting to know someone you haven't talked to yet. Shall we do that? Okay. Who would like to serve cookies? All right. Thank you. We have two trays, though. We need someone else to serve cookies. Anyone else want to serve cookies? Would you like to serve? Anna, thank you very much. Okay. So find someone you haven't talked to yet and have introduce yourself.
Any of these books I'll leave.